Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Hey, Augie.
Good morning, Nia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm lovely, thank you. Okay, well, I'm feeling lovely. I don't think anybody's ever described me as lovely, but nevertheless.
I think you're loverly, like from My Fair Lady.
Oh, great.
I love reference. That song. I love that. And who doesn't love Audrey Hepburn? Crazy, sad people, because she's marvelous.
And by the way, in regards to that song, listeners and Nia, you ought to give the Roseanne Cash version of that song a listen. She does She does an excellent job with it. And in disclosing a little personal information, when my daughter Mackenzie was a baby, and I was trying to get her to sleep, and I would sing her songs, that would be one of the songs that I would sing.
Oh.
And I did it in the version that Roseanne Cash did. So if you get a chance, give it a listen. There is your musical recommendation for today's podcast episode.
Yes. Oh, the softer side of Augie. I it's fun for me to picture you standing around in the middle of the night trying to sing a baby to sleep. While thinking to yourself, it's okay, I only have 400 more papers to grade. It's all right, sweetheart. You just stay awake as long as you want.
Of course, now my daughter's of the age to where she has concluded that my voice is good for putting people of all ages to sleep.
You know, that's going to come in handy though when she's a teenager and she's like a sloth and she sleeps 17 hours a day or whatever it is that sleep. You can just talk to her for a few minutes and she'll fall asleep.
Yes.
But you don't put me to sleep. And today you have a new commission for us.
Ah, the infamous Tower Commission. Okay.
The Tower Commission. John Tower. Was he a congressman or a...
He was a senator from the state of Texas. Yes.
But, can I tell you what I think the precipitating event was? I think the precipitating event was Ronald Reagan standing on the street with those three walnut things with the pea underneath. And you know how they get passersby to stop and be like, okay, put down your $10. And then if you can tell me which one the pea is under, then I will give you $10, but you never win. Cause hello, they know how to work that game.
Yes.
That's pretty much what that event feels like. Cause I know that Iran was involved, and I know that there was the Sandinistas were involved, and there were guns, and there was money, and there was spying, but it all feels like one of those shell games.
It was one big shell game. In Nia, officially the precipitating event was the infamous Iran-Contra scandal during the Ronald Reagan presidency. So basically, listeners, Iran-Contra, okay, was where the United States did an arms deal with the Iranian government, okay? And this was the Iranian government after the Iranian hostage crisis, okay, of the late 1970s. Right.
I was going to say, these were the same people who had just taken Americans at the American embassy hostage for 444 days.
That's right. So we were talking about, you know, 5-6 years later, okay, the U.S. government. Okay, this gets very convoluted, so listeners, please bear with me, okay? So, after the Iranian hostage crisis, the United States was struggling to have good working relations with many countries in the Middle East. Okay. And in Lebanon, Hezbollah, okay, which is a group that was backed by the Iranians, were holding 7 additional Americans hostage. Okay. These were diplomats, these were private contractors. And Iran at that time was in a war with the Iraqis, and the Iranians needed weapons. So the deal that got proposed was that if the United States sold weapons to the Iranians, the Iranians would promise to put pressure on Hezbollah to release these hostages.
Even though it we had been declared as national policy that we do not negotiate with terrorists.
Yes. So that was
sort of indirectly negotiating with terrorists at this point.
So the Reagan administration was between a rock and a hard spot, right? On one hand, we have this official policy that Nia just mentioned. The U.S. government never negotiates with terrorists. On the other hand, the press, and not for nothing, certain Democratic members of Congress were putting pressure on the Reagan administration to bring these 7 hostages home. So within the Reagan administration, there were parts of his National Security Council that were advocating making this arms deal. Now, the Secretary of Defense, who was Caspar Weinberger, and the Secretary of State, George Shultz, okay, advised against making the deal. But they were overridden by President Reagan, because for Reagan, he wanted the hostages home, right? He wanted the hostages home. Now, also within the National Security Council were staffers who thought, well, the money we would make on the arms deal, we could allocate some of that money. And by the way, it was a $30 million arms deal. So we're not
talking, which in 1980s money was actual money.
Yeah, it was serious.
In the era of trillions of dollars spent on things, that doesn't seem like a lot of money. But we hadn't yet had trillion-dollar packages the way we have in the 2000s going forward. So in the 80s, when you say $30 million, you're talking about a lot of money.
It was a lot of money. And these National Security Council staffers wanted to reallocate some of that money. Now, first of all, the arms deal was going to have to be black. And we discussed this in previous podcast episodes. A black budget item, okay, is not made public. It's typically not even shared with members of Congress. So they were going to reallocate some of that money to the Sandinistas fighting in Nicaragua.
And on a budget, that looks like a number, and then next to it, a blank where it says, we are not going to tell you what this number buys.
Yes, right?
But they tell you the number, because in the budget, you have to tell people the numbers. Even Congress gets to know the amounts, but they don't, but there'll be sort of an insert our secretive thing here.
And the Sandinistas, okay, were fighting the communist regime in Nicaragua. And the Sandinistas, historically, had bankrolled their opposition to the communist regime in Nicaragua by selling drugs.
And they weren't exactly the nicest
no
people even in the world.
even though the Reagan administration, even though President Reagan made reference to them as the equivalent of the founding fathers in the United States.
Yeah, I'm going to beg to differ with Ronald Reagan on that. The Sandinistas were not, you know how they talk about the lesser of two evils? Yeah. That's kind of what you're talking about here. But I mean, okay, the Sandinistas were not the good guys. They were just in that instance. And also, listeners, the thought of communism in taking root in nations within our hemisphere was hugely terrifying to a lot of the Cold War folks who had been involved in all that. And Reagan came through the Cold War era. Like, he had Cold War thinking, which was, you cannot let the communists get a foothold in your hemisphere. Cuba's bad enough, but at least it's an island, right? Like, at least it's a little island off, you know, and it's close enough to Florida, we can keep an eye on it. But you start going with Central America, then if the other countries fall, then communism is right on our doorstep, and what are we going to do about that?
Yeah, because as we've discussed in previous podcast episodes, whether when we had Dr. Judy Twigg as a guest or Dr. Bill Newman as a guest, okay? In the Cold War, okay, the United States, even the Soviet Union, basically viewed nations around the world as either they were with us or against us, right?
Right, and proxies for democracy or communism.
Communism, that's right. So, and the problem for Reagan is, in the midterm elections in 1982, the Democrats regained control of both houses of Senate. And they passed, an amendment for a defense spending bill, and it's referred to by the name of the member of Congress, the Boland Amendment, that explicitly prohibited, the United States federal government assisting, the Sandinistas, So the Reagan administration had, if you will, another limitation here, They were told in law that they could not back, not the Sandinistas, The Sandinistas were the communists, The Contras were
the Contras.
So I'm going to correct myself here, guys. You almost need a scorecard here for all the players, right?
The Sandinistas were the communists.
The communists were the
and
communists.
And the Contras
were the quote unquote pro democracy capitalists, right? Again, they weren't good people.
Right, bunch of drug dealers and
yes, right,
They didn't want communism, but not for good reasons in the sense of they wanted democracy so much as under communism, they probably would not have been able to continue doing what they had been doing. And making that kind of money, because that's not how communism works. So their motivations were incredibly selfish. It wasn't like...
Yes, right?
It wasn't like it was warm and fuzzy.
Yeah.
Oh, we're pro-democracy. We want to be like America. It was more like... we don't really want the communists because they're going to step on a lot of what we're trying to do.
So Reagan instructs his national security advisor, Bob McFarlane, to find a way to assist the drug dealing Contras. So Reagan, and we've discussed this in previous podcast episodes, Reagan was hands-off in regards to details.
Right.
He was a big-picture president. I want to achieve X, and I'm going to go ahead and let my staff in the White House figure out how to do it. And he wasn't necessarily concerned about the details, I mean, Reagan was very clear, here are the goals. I've decided them as president. Now you guys need to figure out how to do it. And Bob McFarlane, as National Security Advisor, and then the National Security Council, okay, came up with a rather ingenious way to achieve both of these policy goals. Okay, get those hostages home from Lebanon while also funding the Contras in the civil war going on in Nicaragua. The problem is, okay, the arms deal to bring the hostages home, okay, was negotiating with quote unquote terrorists. Okay.
Right.
Moreover, it was an arms deal with a country, okay, that a mere 5-6 years previous held a whole bunch of Americans hostage, right?
Right. Our relationship with Iran has been rocky since we installed the Shah over the wishes of the people.
Yes.
Because we liked the Shah and he was pro-America. And then the youth in Iran had a revolution and they were like, you know what? You got to go, bozo. And you and your American pals. Like that's where you get the hostage crisis and all of that stuff is in direct response to the Americans forcing a person on them that they did not want to be the head of their government. So then, one could argue that we started it.
Sure. I mean, and again, okay, the Middle East has been a proxy, okay, for world superpowers, okay, for centuries, right?
Right.
Not decades, centuries.
Right. And oil has just made it worse.
Yes. And then in our own hemisphere, okay, you have the United States Congress telling the executive branch it can't do X, okay? And the Reagan administration,
which, like any toddler, oh yes, I can.
Right? I mean, again, we've discussed this in previous podcast episodes. If there is a common pathology among modern presidents, okay, it is this: in foreign affairs, the United States Congress can't tell the president as commander in chief what to do, right? And Reagan was no different. Okay.
In terms of Reagan, what I think is fascinating about that is that he had two very disparate thoughts held in his head at the same time, which was he was very much anti-drug, right? He had the war on drugs, just say no, all of that stuff. Nancy Reagan took it up as part of her legacy, but also part of his legacy. So he would have not liked what the Contras were doing. But as previously noted, he despised communism.
Yeah, he referred to the Soviet Union as the evil empire in a speech to ministers.
Right.
To ministers.
Right. And you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, right? Like he very much was known as anti-communist. So for him, I'm assuming that looking at a bunch of drug dealers, but who are not communist, and then the communists, he chose to go with the one side versus the other.
Yes.
And in order to get the money to do that and to get the hostages back, it's like, great, I can do all of these things and this is all going to work out wonderfully. But that's not really what happened, is it?
No. In 1986, a newspaper in Lebanon reported the arms deal between the U.S. and the Iranians.
Oh, I didn't realize the Lebanese broke the story.
Yes.
Good for them.
Reagan initially denied that he negotiated with the Iranians or Hezbollah, okay? But he eventually retracted the statement. But then, okay, Pandora's box had been opened, right? Congress, the American media, they all wanted to know what was going on. So at first, Reagan thought, well, if I do an internal investigation, this will satisfy the jackals that are hovering around okay, the carcass, right?
Right.
So he first had his attorney general do an investigation. Okay.
Was that Meese?
Yes. Edwin Meese. And Meese actually found and reported that the National Security Council, okay, reallocated $18 out of the $30 million that the U.S. made on the arms deal to the Contras. Okay?
Okay.
At that point, okay, Congress was like, we need an independent investigation. So Reagan creates the Tower Commission. Okay? The Tower Commission. The Tower Commission basically was comprised of three people. Okay? John Tower, a former senator from Texas, former Secretary of State Ed Muskie, okay, who was a Democrat, and then former National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, okay, who Bill Newman and I both referred to as an exemplar of government service in a previous podcast episode, okay? All right?
Right. But can I just say something about the size of this commission?
Yes.
I'm not trying to be cynical. But if you put three people on a commission, you're not looking for an in-depth
find the truth
involved,
yes.
You know, no. Go to the ends of the earth. This is not like some of the commissions where there have been significantly larger numbers of resources thrown at the commission in order to get to the bottom of this. This sounds a little to me in my cynical heart that maybe they didn't really want this commission to find a whole lot of information slash money slash stuff.
You are correct, Nia. Not only did it have a very limited staff, it also had a very limited charge from President Reagan. He asked the Tower Commission to examine the proper role of the National Security Council staff in conducting national security operations. That was it. That was it.
So in fact, their scope did not include the money. It didn't include what the money went for.
Or
none of that. How it got there, where it went, what happened. None of that was part of their scope. Their scope was simply, did this National Security Advisor do what they were supposed to do?
Yes. And even though Reagan said publicly he wanted all the facts to come out, the commission, okay, had no subpoena power, limited resources. They were given 3 months to do their work.
So it was sort of a show commission.
It was a show commission, okay? Of all the commissions we are going to talk about in our series about government commissions, this is the one that I would point to as sane, okay? Undercuts any kind of faith or legitimacy the public might have in government commissions.
Which is unfortunate because all three of the members of this commission were upstanding people.
Yes.
Who had served in government for a long period of time and, you know,
had by and large sterling reputations, et cetera. Yes.
Like one of the things that you mentioned about the Warren Commission was that putting Justice Warren in charge of that commission lent weight to the idea of the commission's work. Here is the Chief Justice. It's an important, serious thing. Right. But that doesn't always carry the day because all three of these men were important, serious people. But because they were also not given any sort of support, it sounds like you can ask questions, but you can't make people answer. Like, that's not a... So if people get in there and they say, I don't want to answer, there's nothing you can do about it. Or if they decide not to come to your commission, there's nothing you can do about it. That really, I would think, would hobble and inhibit their work.
Yeah, and the Tire Commission also got undercut by the fact that in early 1987, the United States Congress then created a select committee who did their own investigation. And in the process, in issuing subpoenas of the actors involved, for some of them, granted them immunity from prosecution if they testified. And I want you guys to remember that, because this is going to be part of the, the aftermath, if you will, right?
Well, and remember that investigations from Congress do have subpoena power.
Yes, they do. Okay.
And there's nothing that can remove that or inhibit that.
If you have been called via subpoena to testify in front of Congress, and you're afraid that you're going to say something under oath that could be then used against you in a criminal prosecution, you can have your attorney negotiate with the Congress so that you receive immunity.
Right.
Okay. So the Tower Commission does its work, but at the same time, Congress is also doing its investigation, right? And by the way, the Tower Commission, notwithstanding its limited scope, resources, and basic inability to force anybody to testify, actually did get testimony from 86 witnesses. They also did something that was extremely important for not only the congressional investigation, but then the subsequent independent counsel investigation from what's his name? I want to say Kenneth. It's not Kenneth.
Walsh.
Walsh, yeah.
Yeah, it's Kenneth Walsh, I think.
Okay. But the Tower Commission did go ahead.
Lawrence Walsh.
Yeah, Lawrence Walsh. The Tower Commission did issue a report where they held Reagan accountable for a quote, lax managerial style and aloofness from policy detail.
I like that, aloofness from policy detail. That's a nice way of saying he didn't care how it got done and he didn't want to be told. Don't tell me how you're doing it, just do it. I don't want to be looped in on the details. And there's two ways that one could think about that, I think. There's this idea of, I don't want to know because I don't want to be held accountable, which I don't think was the case. I think in Reagan's case, it was, I don't want to know because I don't care. I don't care how it gets done. I want it to get done. As you were saying earlier, a 50,000 foot view rather than a 10 foot view, right? I want this thing to happen. Go out and make it happen. And his do whatever you need to do to make it happen.
Of presidents of roughly the last 50 to 60 years, Nia, the one president that you and anybody could safely say was not a policy wonk was Ronald Reagan.
Right.
He was big picture, right? Jimmy Carter was a policy wonk. Okay. Bush 41, had been a career bureaucrat most of his life, right?
Clinton dug into the weeds for fun.
Yeah, Bill Clinton loved that kind of stuff. I mean, one of the criticisms of Clinton was, he would have the White House staff up all night talking about policy, right? Okay. Now you could argue, as many have, Bush 43 was more of a CEO, big picture type, okay? But, Barack Obama, very comfortable with policy details, right?
Right.
Donald Trump, would inadvertently get involved in policy details because he wanted things done like immediately, right? So he would have to endure policy details because at the bottom, you know, the bottom line at the end of the meeting, Donald Trump would say, and it's going to get done tomorrow, right? Okay. Okay. But Ronald Reagan was, you know, hey, guys, I don't care how you get it done. Okay. I want it done. Right. I want it done.
Right.
I was, you know.
Well, and part of that, forgive me, because I have mixed memories of Ronald Reagan, right? Parts of me are very fond of Ronald Reagan. The other parts of me are like, oh, a criminal. One of the most criminal of all the presidents that never went to prison because of all the criminal stuff that happened on his watch. Not necessarily by him, but I think his administration had either the highest number of criminal investigations or one of the highest numbers. And this was just one of many scandals. But Ronald Reagan treated the presidency, I think, as a connection to the people, the government connecting to the people. He was really good at giving speeches and getting people interested in government and what government was doing and that kind of thing. And I think that comes from his acting career. And it also comes from being the president of SAG. I mean, and governor of California, he had done these things before in his career that were PR related sort of, I mean, one could argue that it's Reagan who builds back interest in the government after Nixon, not Carter. Right. One could argue that comes from Reagan. It comes from his sort of excitement and hope and communication style, that Jimmy Carter was sort of a stopgap president. And then you get a president that really gets people back to
Ronald Reagan,
government, you know, and hoping in government and that kind of thing.
You know, it's morning in America.
Right.
Right? It's a brand new day. Right. Instead of focusing on, you know, all the problems the country has faced, you know, let's think about all the opportunities.
Right.
And you are correct, right? Ronald Reagan is kind of sort of the pole star for Republicans in this country. But for many Democrats, it was a poorly criminally run presidential administration.
With a really nice CEO. I think Democrats will say that Reagan was a nice CEO.
Oh, hey, I mean, there were many.
And he seemed like a good fella.
I mean, many Democratic members of Congress liked Ronald Reagan personally. I mean, I still like to regale my students with how the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, okay, old school, New Deal Democrat, okay, from Massachusetts, who believed in big government, right? Whereas Ronald Reagan was just like, no, we're going to shrink the size of the government, okay? But Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, okay, with some regularity, met at the White House and shared drinks and had conversations, and they liked each other personally, okay? But in regards to policy, okay, they were miles apart, right? But, you know, the danger of that kind of managerial style was on display in Iran-Contra. And the Tower Commission called out Reagan for it, right? Right. Called out Reagan for it.
Do you think that it's, sorry.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
It seems to me that the Tower Commission's report also suffered from competing with wall-to-wall television coverage of the congressional hearings, because a lot of those figures went in and testified before Congress. I don't recall that Reagan did, although I think he probably testified for the commission. but I don't remember him testifying before Congress. But a lot of the other people involved did testify before Congress. And I say that because I remember watching it on television. I remember watching sort of Oliver North with all of his medals and his uniform and sitting very upright and, you know, and giving testimony. That's a, I mean, I hate to say that they scooped the commission, but they kind of did, because we are a visual nation in a lot of ways, and they gave us a lot of visual to look at during the Iran-Contra hearings that maybe the Tower Commission didn't get quite so much airplay.
Yeah, Reagan did give a deposition for independent counsel Welsh's investigation.
Okay.
Various other figures in the scandal did testify in front of Congress. Bob McFarland did. You mentioned Oliver North. He most famously did. He testified in his uniform with all of his ribbons. Okay. John Poindexter, who ran the National Security Council, he testified. And a number of them were charged, indicted, and convicted, though many of them had their convictions overturned. McFarland was sentenced for 2 years of probation and $20,000 in fines. Oliver North was charged with 12 counts of conspiracy and perjury. He was convicted, but later his conviction was overturned on appeal because the federal court found that Congress had given him and a number of other figures in Iran-Contra transactional immunity, meaning that they got immunity because they were willing to turn over relevant information and documents, etc. So even if they were not completely truthful, unfortunately, Congress was so excited and so impatient to get their testimony that they gave them immunity. And therefore, they could not be prosecuted. So North got off. Poindexter eventually had his convictions overturned. Only one person actually served jail time, a private contractor, okay? Was the only one who got jail time.
Really? Okay? In that entire thing?
Of that entire thing. And we're talking about dozens of people who were involved in this. I mean, and that's one of the truly stunning things about all of this. Okay. These folks thought that they could go ahead and do this covertly without ever getting caught. There were so many moving parts. Okay. From, you know, selling the weapons to the Iranians, to negotiating with Hezbollah, then channeling part of the revenue from the arms deal to the Contras and hoping that nobody in the Contras would go ahead and, you know, leak the fact, right. Yeah, that the U.S. government was bankrolling their civil war against the Sandinistas.
Well, and then also, they didn't use all the money for that. So then there was money floating around that people were like, where'd this money come from? Oh, we don't know. We just found it in our pockets. Here, here's $12 million. That's a lot of money to not explain where you got it, right? Like, it's not even so much the whole, but it's the extra that would make people say, wait a minute, where'd this $12 million come from? Oh, we sold some stuff. What, like you had a yard sale?
Sale, right?
You know,
and that's why, by the way, Independent Counsel Walsh really went after Secretary of Defense Weinberger and Secretary of State Shultz, because they maintained all along that they advised against the arms deal, okay, and were completely unaware that part of the proceeds of the arms deal went to the Contras, okay? And when Bush 41 became president, he went ahead and gave a pardon to Weinberger for any future prosecution, which again, you know, you want to talk about, you know, if there's smoke, there's got to be fire. Why are you going to go ahead and give somebody a pardon, okay, if they didn't do anything wrong, okay?
And so I put to you that that's because President Bush had been head of the CIA.
Well,
and he understood where you get clandestine money and how much clandestine money flows from one place to another without anybody knowing exactly where it came from or where it went.
Yeah, and are you going to go ahead and prosecute people who went ahead and took this money where they didn't know where the money came from and then used it for other operational imperatives, right? Okay, if that was going to be the case, there's a whole bunch of staffers in the CIA from the top way down to the bottom operationally, okay, who could get indicted for violating law, people's civil rights, et cetera, right? I mean, you want to talk about opening up a can of worms, okay? Okay, good Lord, right? I mean, you're talking about prosecuting multiple, you know, administration staffers and fighting the Cold War, okay?
Right.
I mean, you know, not to be indelicate about this, but in fighting the Cold War, okay, the United States government did some really bad stuff with some really bad people.
Right.
Right? Okay? You know,
for and those, justified it from the point of view of
we're fighting communism.
Right. At least these aren't communists.
That's right.
They may be drug dealing jerk faces, but they're not communists.
That's right.
Okay. And so we will take them over, right? We look at it now from the modern lens of the failure of communism to really take hold, except in China. Well, and one could argue Cuba, but Cuba's a bit on the small side to be considered a major power in communism. But other than China, like, it's pretty much failed in Russia. Now what you have is an authoritarian government, not a communist government. So we modernly looking at it and saying, I don't know what the big deal was. Well, the big deal was that at the time, the Soviet Union was still the Soviet Union. Like, it was still holding together as a communist force in the world.
And it had as a stated aim the spread of that form of government around the world.
Right.
Right. So, you know, the difficulty or dilemma for the United States, okay, and other Western democracies was, are we going to let it? And once they made a decision, no, we're going to stop the spread of communism, then everything was viewed through that lens in regards to U.S. foreign policy.
Right. I believe one of my favorite political science professors uses the phrase to a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
Yes.
Right. Like if the problem is communism, pull out your hammer and start whacking on it. Nothing else matters except solving that.
Yes.
Which is how we end up in Vietnam. It's how we end up in all these other countries where we're fighting proxy wars. It's how all of that comes about from the end of World War II on, right?
Yes.
Until sort of the end of the Reagan era, where you now see the dying out of, except, as I said, China. But I have a question for you about this particular episode.
Sure.
Much has been made of the I don't recall, I don't remember, I'm not entirely certain of the details answers that Ronald Reagan gave.
Yeah.
About the Iran-Contra, not during, but post-Iran-Contra in his second presidency or in his second term.
Yeah, during his second term, he gave a deposition to independent counsel Lawrence Walsh.
Right.
And in it, I can't remember the exact number, but it's close to 100 or a little over 100 times President Reagan said he did not recall.
Is that attributed to his early onset Alzheimer's?
Yeah, initially, and again, guys, you know, we're looking at this from a millennium where we have much more knowledge about Alzheimer's, okay, and the early signs of it. But in the 1980s, okay, it was not a common diagnosis, particularly of elderly Americans. And we weren't always entirely sure of the early signs that somebody did have Alzheimer's. So when Reagan said that, okay, all those times, I don't recall, in his deposition, his opponents, okay, were like, okay, he's covering up the truth.
He's stonewalling.
Right? Yeah, he's stonewalling, right? Now, for most presidential scholars, they truly believe now that that was the clearest sign that Reagan was already suffering from symptoms of early onset Alzheimer's. And, you know, after he left office, okay, he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, okay?
And died relatively quickly.
Yeah.
Relatively. Okay.
Yeah, relatively quickly. I mean, let's face it, folks, okay? I mean, and we've talked about this and you could say, unfortunately, joked about it, but many former presidents don't live long after they leave office, okay? Right. LBJ did not. Carter is an exception.
Yes.
Reagan did not. Bush 41 did, okay?
And our current presidents have.
Yeah, okay.
Thank goodness.
We've been doing a little bit better. But, I mean, you know, many of our previous presidents, okay, after their, you know, one term or two terms in office, they didn't live long afterwards.
Well, and one could argue that it is an enormously exhausting office to hold.
Yes.
And if you're already at an advanced age when you take that office.
And Reagan was.
It cannot be good for your health to continue. But where it leads me to wonder is, and I know this is pure speculation, but this is what we do at the end of these, at these commission reports, is speculation. I have to wonder if some of the people in under him knew that he didn't know exactly what was going on, or that he wasn't recalling details completely, and they used that. Or to they their took advantage, right.
Yeah, they took advantage of it, right?
To do a thing they wanted to do, right? They wanted to solve these problems. One, that probably in fairness to them, they wanted to get hostages back, because we always want to get hostages back. Nobody ever wants to see Americans held in dangerous situations like that. But also, they, a lot of people in government in certain types of positions feel like the ends justify the means, right? Like,
oh, sure. I mean,
if we can do this thing and the president doesn't really remember or doesn't really recall or isn't really sure about what we're doing, then that gives him plausible deniability. So let's just go ahead and do it.
Well, and moreover, and again, guys, listeners, I'm not justifying, or nor am I saying that Oliver North was correct. But the logic of Oliver North was the United States had promised freedom fighters, fighters of communism around the world, that we would have their backs.
Right.
And the United States Congress passes the Bolin Amendment saying we can't do X. Okay. Well, we're leaving our brothers, out to dry, okay, in fighting communism, and we have a responsibility, okay, to get their backs, okay? So even though Congress made it very clear that the U.S. federal government would not give material aid to the Contras, okay, one, okay? Constitutionally, they can't tell the president how to conduct foreign policy. And two, okay, we're fighting communism.
Right.
And our president has given us the broad charge, okay, of supporting the Contras. Okay. You couple that with the fact that, you know, Ronald Reagan just in general had a managerial style of, I don't want to know the details. Okay. Yeah, they took advantage. Okay. Yeah. Did some of them perhaps know that his grasp of operational detail, okay, one, he wasn't interested, but two, okay, maybe increasingly he didn't have that capacity? It wouldn't surprise me, okay? I mean, let's face it, Nia, okay? You and I have had bosses where once we know how they do things, okay, do we figure out how to go ahead and take advantage of how they do things, okay, for our own benefit so that we can do our jobs the way we want to do? Most of us do that.
Right.
Right? Okay? Most of us do that.
Although if my boss is listening now, I never do that now.
Yeah. and Jason Arnold, as Department Chair of Political Science, if you're listening to this episode, I follow all of your mandates and recommendations to the letter.
Exactly. on that CYA moment, I think though that what really could be summed up to me, at least about the Tower Commission and about the Iran-Contra affair in general, is that it's complicated. It is enormously complicated. Everybody in it had reasons for doing what they were doing, and whether they are good or bad, it's not as nuanced as, I mean, it's not as simple as, you know, this is either on or off. There's an enormous spread between.
And I tell my students when I discuss Iran-Contra, particularly in constitutional law, guys, one of the values of checks and balances is making sure that no one branch of government can act unilaterally. And this is one of those situations where we had decades, if not a couple centuries, of practice where the Congress and the courts had basically said, the Office of President conducts U.S. foreign policy. And it's not a big shock that occasionally you'll have presidential administrations that go too far.
Right.
And that's the danger of not having, okay, robust, actually functioning checks and balances. Because I got to admit, okay, I watched, okay, in preparation for this podcast episode, some of the congressional hearings. Okay. And I had to start laughing when I heard members of Congress act shocked that a presidential administration thought that they could go ahead and largely conduct U.S. foreign policy unilaterally. I was just like, you know, you guys are a bunch of two-faced, hypocritical, no good, blah, blah, blahs, because historically, your institution has basically said to the Office of President, there is a crisis or hotspot in this part of the world. You go solve it.
Right. Go fix it.
Okay. Here's a whole bunch of money. You guys go fight communism.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And now afterwards, you know, again,
you're going to clutch your pearls and act like, how is this even possible?
Well, yeah. Right. Okay. It kind of sort of reminds me of, the character played by Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men, okay, when he goes ahead and, you know, says, you know, how dare you question, okay, the blanket of freedom that I provide you,
right?
Okay, you basically want me to go ahead and provide it, but now you're questioning how I provide it, okay? Right. So I can understand why, and this is just an example of one presidential administration, okay? I can give examples from presidential administrations ad nauseum to where their basic attitude was, you know, we are the to quote the U.S. Supreme Court in Curtis Wright Corporation from 1936, okay? The president is the sole organ of U.S. foreign policy. Well, if you got the highest court in the land basically telling you, as the office of president, you are, okay, the, you know, perpetrator, creator, you are the man, if you will, in regards to U.S. foreign policy, then of course you're going to be like, yeah, we can do whatever. And our commander in chief has said, we want the hostages home and we want to
fight communism.
We want to fight communism. Okay.
Okay. So we can do this. We can kill a bunch of birds with a bunch of stones. We can.
Yes. Okay.
Although we are not for killing birds with stones, by the way.
Yes. Okay. That's just a metaphor.
That's a metaphor. Okay.
That's a metaphor. But the downside is, okay, where is the checks and balances? Where is the accountability?
Right.
Okay. And listeners, I hope you guys do take away from this particular discussion of the Tyra Commission. Okay. The Tyra Commission, the congressional hearings, and the independent counsel report from Lawrence Walsh all go ahead and highlight how you need to have accountability measures in place, even if it makes conducting U.S. foreign policy more difficult.
Yep.
Yep.
Thank you for that summary.
Yeah.
And I'll see you for the next commission report.
Thanks, Nia. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this podcast.